And hello, Sun's House listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means once again it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now to close to 5 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Etta Extraordinaire Goes to the White House. And then it's Sam's Super Seats, Raven Gets Tricked, Extra Yarn, and if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with How to Find an Elephant. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Etta Extraordinaire Goes to the White House. This is Etta, and Etta loves going on field trips. And Etta's class was personally invited to see the White House, where the president lives. It was going to be extraordinary. Etta was excited to see the famous cherry blossoms. They were Grandma Bess's favorite flowers in the whole wide, wonderful world. Every year, they turn the city of Washington, D.C. pink. Pink, pink, pink. When the class arrived at the White House, Miss Prabhu said they'd vote on what to do, the same way they decide things in Washington, D.C. Etta's friend Anna wasn't sure what a vote was, so she asked Etta just in case. A vote is when you are given different choices and you choose which one you think is best. The choice with the most votes is the winner, Etta explained. Chloe wanted to play hide and seek. Emily thought a game of tug of war would be best. And Isaac couldn't wait to see all the books in the presidential library. Etta thought and thought and thought until she got an extraordinary idea. Let's have a cherry blossom party on the White House lawn. They could collect pink petals and make paintings. They could sing and dance to the sound of birds. And then they could eat pink ice pops and cupcakes. It would be extraordinary. Everyone had a chance to talk about their ideas. Emilio said tug of war would be a blast. Chloe said hide and seek would give everyone a chance to explore. Isaac said they would learn so much from reading some of the books. Etta's turn came, and she was bubbling over with joy. People come from all over the world to see these famous cherry blossoms, Etta said. Grandma Bess told me they were a gift from Japan, and they are the most perfect pink flowers in the world. Everyone wrote their favorite activity on the note cards to cast their vote. Etta felt nervous. Miss Prabhu started counting the votes, 4 for tug of war, 6 for hide and seek, 4 for the library, and 10 votes for Etta's extraordinary cherry blossom party. The whole class cheered. Working as a team, they decided to help set up by following Etta's spectacular 4-step plan. Step 1, place a big blanket on the lawn. Step 2, make delicious treats. Step 3, decorate, decorate, decorate. Step 4, throw an extraordinary party. The party was almost perfect, but suddenly a big dark cloud appeared in the sky. I think it's going to rain, said Anna. No, 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 it won't rain, said Etta. Just then, the wind picked up and blew away all the decorations. Etta rubbed her lucky pearls, whispering, "Please don't let it rain. Please don't let it rain. Please don't let it rain. If it rains, the party is over. One drop came, then another, then it started pouring. I'm sorry, class, Miss Pabu yelled. Everyone, hurry, go inside. Etta just wanted to go home. Luckily, Etta's friends are good at working together, and they had lots of extraordinary ideas, too. Chloe brought the picnic blanket to the red room, where she was planning to play hide-and-seek. Emilio gathered all the snacks, and Isaac read up on perfect rainy day activities. Etta walked in and couldn't believe her eyes. It was the biggest surprise, the most extraordinary cherry blossom party in the whole wide, wonderful world. They threw the pink petals in the air, made paintings, ate pink ice pops, and danced. It was the best field trip ever. The vote was in. Etta's friends are extraordinary. Sam's Super Seats. Hi, my name is Sam, and I love to make people laugh. I love myself, and I love to learn. Today, I'm going to my favorite place for back-to-school shopping with my best friends, Sydney and Sarah. Daddy helps me get ready so Mommy can sleep in before he heads to work. We brush our teeth, sing songs into our hairbrushes, and after Daddy combs my hair, we do something super fun. Every morning, we say four things we like about me into the mirror. Today, I like my dance skills, my eyes, and my fingers, too. And today, your smile is my favorite thing about you, Daddy says. He's right. It is pretty great. Mommy is up now, getting dressed. I can hear her singing. What does a ghost say when he is upset? I ask as Daddy gives me a piggyback ride downstairs to the living room. I don't know what. This is unbelievable. Daddy laughs and says goodbye with a forehead kiss. Before Mommy and I leave, I'm busy resting with my favorite super seat, Misty. I have cerebral palsy, so I know that when my legs get tired, I have to stop and sit. Yesterday at the park, I overdid it on the swings, and my right leg still hurts a little. Misty is the living room couch, named after my favorite dancer, Misty Copeland. When we aren't doing pirouettes before dance class, we play I Spy and laugh at our silly answers. Misty loves to dance, and I know she loves me. She's comfortable and graceful. That's what makes her a super seat. Ready to go? Mommy asks. Misty wishes me well with a wink and a smile, and I promise her a rematch with a wave and a smile of my own. My second favorite super seat is in the back of Mommy's car. Whenever we go anywhere, I get to hang out with Lenny. We share secrets, and she always has a joke ready to make me laugh. Lenny makes me feel important and safe. She is funny, cool, and kind. That's why she is a super seat of mine. Lainey cracks another joke when Sarah and Sydney crawl into the car. We laugh and laugh, and Mommy asks us, what's so funny? Nothing, we say, before laughing again. At the mall, we see cute shirts, cute pants and skirts, and cute shoes. My favorite colors are pink and blue. Sydney's are green and purple, and Sarah really likes orange and brown. We are going to look so cute when we go back to school because we've got brains and beauty. Cuteness isn't just about clothes. It's about feeling good on the inside and outside, feeling strong and feeling ready to learn. Sarah, Sydney, and I walk around the mall with Mommy, and she helps us put together 2 outfits each. Sarah poses in front of the mirror, her orange skirt and sunflower-covered overalls shining under the light, like the models in magazines she wants to be. She is quiet but confident and loves clothes as much as me. "I feel strong," she says. "You look strong," I reply. "I feel good," Sydney says. "You look so cute," I reply. I walk the runway, limping with pride, with my left hand on my hip. I love the way I feel, like I could fly. I show off my jean skirt with pink hearts by the pockets and matching pink jacket, while Sydney stands next to Mommy, pretending to take pictures with her hands. Her blue jeans and green sweater with stars on the sleeves remind me of all the stylish photographers she looks up to. Sarah, Sydney, Mommy, and me pose and play pretend before we are all in a pile on the floor giggling. We buy friendship bracelets, and Sydney helps me tie mine around my wrist. "Thank you," I say before we group hug. "Let's wear these on the first day back to school," Sarah says. We all high five. I love my friends. They help me when it's hard to do things and cheer me up with hugs when I am sad about it being hard. When they're sad, I like to make them laugh. Going back to school is going to be so much fun. After walking so much, my legs start to ache and tingle, like they fell asleep. That's how I know that I'm tired. I want to walk and run and play all day, but sometimes a little rest goes a long way. "I am tired. I need to stop," I say. Mommy smiles and says, "Me too. It's been a long day." We stand still, holding hands, while we look for a place to sit. Mommy spots a place before the rest of us. "Girls, let's go sit on that bench over there," she says. And so we do. We sit down and take some pictures with silly faces and some with big smiles. The bench is not a super seat yet because we are still strangers, and its hard wood pokes my legs. "Hi, I'm Maya," the bench says. "I know, I'm not that comfy, but I can help you rest when you're tired." "Thank you," I tell Maya, "but maybe next time you could ask to get pillows?" I am still tired, but I won't be forever. "I will only be a few more minutes," I say. "Take your time. People watching is fun," Sydney says. Mommy squeezes my hand like she does when she wants me to remember that she loves me. I remember I love her too. We watch lots of people, and we see other kids with their families back to school shopping like us. I can't wait to sit at a new desk and rest while we learn about places, people, and things. I can't wait to meet a new super seat. To keep shopping, I need to rest here for a while with my friends Mommy, new clothes, and a super seat in training. But then I have one of the best ideas I've had all day. When we get home, we sit on Misty while Mommy grabs jewelry for us to try on from her room. She comes back with rings, necklaces, and barrettes for our hair. My space buns are perfect, so I grab a ring. Sarah and Sydney take some time to decide. I look at myself in the mirror Mommy brought downstairs. When I'm done, I see Sarah with 2 necklaces and Sydney with barrettes on either side of her curly brown hair. We all take turns looking in the mirror again. Today, I like my dance skills, my eyes, and my fingers too. What I like most about myself every day, though, is that I'm me. It isn't always easy, but being me is the best, and sometimes I need a little rest. Raven gets tricked. And here's a little note from the author. My family has a long history in our traditional territory of the Salish Sea on the west coast of British Columbia. Like many indigenous people in North America, my family's history includes surviving the residential school system, the 60s scoop, the foster care system, and child and family services. My family has a longer and more important history of self-sufficiency, balance with nature, and showing love for those around us. I have learned through studying Coast Salish culture and sitting with elders and storytellers from our communities that storytelling is a basic building block of a healthy community. It was used to teach simonium, the proper way to behave, and what is important in life. Storytelling was one of the many parts of Coast Salish culture, damaged by colonialism. In reading and sharing these stories with the Sunimom in your life, you are making an important step toward reconciliation by valuing Indigenous ways of knowing and teaching. One day, Sumi, the little deer, went to his food stores. He saw that there were no salmon, dried elk, or fern roots left. The only food he had was a half basket of berries. What am I going to do? He wondered. It is a long time before cousin Thokeek swims upstream or the Yala begins to grow. What am I going to eat? Sumi looked up and saw cousin Spal flying by. Why will Spal not share with me? He thought. I share with him, but all he does is trick me. How can I get him to share with me? I know, Sumi said, as he headed back into his house with his berries. That night, Sumi began to mash the berries while he sang, "Go down to the beach, go down to the beach, hum, hum, hum." Sumi was happy with his plan. He ate some of the mashed berries and went to bed, pleased with himself. Very early the next morning, Sumi headed over to his cousin's treehouse. Sumi poured out the mashed berries onto the snow under Spal's tree. He then danced in the berries, mixing them into the snow while he sang, "Go down to the beach, go down to the beach, hmm, 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 go down to the beach." When he was done dancing and singing, the berries had mixed with so much snow, and it had all begun to freeze. Sumi had made a large mound of red snow. Eventually, Spal woke up and saw the red snow outside of his house. He was excited, as he had never seen red snow before. "What is this, Sumi? Is it yummy? Can I taste it?" he asked his cousin. "Of course you can, Spal," replied Sumi, "and if you like it, then we will share it." Spal tasted the snow, and when he decided that he liked it, then they did just that. Each of them began taking their half of the red snow back to their houses. When Spal took his first load to his house, he realized that he needed to make room for all the tasty snow. So Spal collected the dried salmon he had saved for winter and took it down to the beach. He wasn't sure why he took it there, but he just threw the salmon onto the sand and returned to his trees to collect more red snow. Sumi excused himself from collecting the red snow and snuck down to the beach. There he collected Spal's discarded salmon. He took the salmon to his house. He made a fire. He then roasted some of the salmon for a snack and went to sleep. Spall collected all the red snow that he could fit into his house. To hide his trickery of taking more than his share, Spall mixed the leftover red snow with some of the white snow to make up the difference. Spall then retired to his house, where he had piled up the red snow in all four corners. He built a fire, snacked on the red snow, and went to sleep happy. For some reason, Spall woke up in the middle of the night very cold and hungry. So he built the fire up bigger, ate some more of the red snow, and went back to sleep. The next morning, Sumi awoke to the sound of his cousin calling out for help. Sumi ran over to Spall's treehouse and opened the front door. To his surprise, a flood of red water came pouring out of Spall's house and washed them to the ground. They were both soaking wet and cold, so Sumi invited Spall over to his house. While they warmed up by Sumi's fire, Spall asked for a hot drink and something to eat, for he was still very hungry. Sumi gave Spall a piece of his salmon roasted over hot coals. "This is very good salmon, Sumi. It tastes just like my salmon," Spall exclaimed in amazement. "Do you think I could have some to take home, as all my food is now gone?" "Of course," Sumi said. "Oh, hoi koi cha, Sumi. Hoi koi kwa." Sumi sent the warm and fed raven home with some dried salmon. Because Spall was so happy to have a clean house that smelled like berries, he didn't realize that he had only half of the salmon that he'd had the day before. Even more than that, he was happy to have a friend like Sumi who shared. Extra yarn. On a cold afternoon, in a cold little town, where everywhere you looked was either the white of snow or the black of soot from chimneys, Annabelle found a box filled with yarn of every color. So she went home and knit herself a sweater. And when Annabelle was done, she had some extra yarn. So she knit a sweater for Mars, too. That's her dog. But there was still extra yarn. And when Annabelle and Mars went for a walk, Nate pointed and laughed and said, "You two look ridiculous." "You're just jealous," said Annabelle. "No, I'm not," said Nate. But it turned out he was. And even after she'd made a sweater for Nate and his dog and for herself and for Mars, she still had extra yarn. At school, Annabelle's classmates could not stop talking about her sweater. "Quiet," shouted Mr. Norman. "Quiet, everyone. Annabelle, that sweater of yours is terrible distraction. I cannot teach with everyone turning around to look at you." "Then I'll knit one for everyone," Annabelle said, "so they won't have to turn around." "Impossible," said Mr. Norman. "You can't." But it turned out she could, and she did, even for Mr. Norman. And when she was done, Annabelle still had extra yarn. So she knit sweaters for her mom and dad and for Mr. Pendleton and Mrs. Pendleton and for Dr. Palmer and for little Lewis. She made sweaters for everyone except Mr. Crabtree, who never wore sweaters or even long pants, and who would stand in his shorts with the snow up to his knees. "No sweater for me, thanks," said Mr. Crabtree. So she made Mr. Crabtree a hat. And even then, Annabelle still had extra yarn. She made sweaters for all the dogs and all the cats and for other animals, too. Soon, people thought, soon Annabelle will run out of yarn. But it turned out she didn't. So Annabelle made sweaters for things that didn't even wear sweaters, like bird feeders, mailboxes, and even their house. Things began to change in that little town. News spread of this remarkable girl who never ran out of yarn. And people came to visit from around the world to see all the sweaters and to shake Annabelle's hand. One day, an archduke, who was very fond of clothes, sailed across the sea and demanded to see Annabelle. "Little girl," said the archduke, "I would like to buy that miraculous box of yarn, and I'm willing to offer you $1,000,000. "No, thank you," said Annabelle, who was knitting a sweater for a pickup truck. The archduke's mustache twitched. "2 million," he said. Annabelle shook her head. "No, thanks." "10 million," shouted the archduke. "Take it or leave it." "Leave it," said Annabelle. "I won't sell the yarn." And she didn't. So that night, the archduke hired 3 robbers to break into Annabelle's house. And they stole the box and took it to the archduke, who set off across the snow and sailed over the sea, back to his castle. The archduke put on his favorite song and sat in his best chair. Then he took out the box and he lifted its lid and he looked inside. And the box is completely empty. His mustache quivered. It shivered. It trembled. The archduke hurled the box out the window and shouted, "Little girl, I curse you with my family's curse. You will never be happy again." But, and then it shows her outside with her dog and everyone is wearing yarn. It turned out she was. Okay, I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with how to find an elephant. The best time to look for an elephant is on a dull day when clouds hover on the horizon looking like spaceships and you're thinking up something to do. Well, the best place to find an elephant is in the wild. You will need to pack some food and a pair of binoculars. You may want to take a flute and bring a blanket, one that's tasseled and brightly colored, with a story woven through the cloth to tell the elephant. The first thing you will want to do is climb to the top of the nearest tree. Take out your binoculars and look for something large and gray. If you don't see an elephant, then you will have to go into the jungle. Keep an eye out for elephant footprints. They look like this. But don't expect to hear the elephant's footsteps, because elephants walk on tiptoe. When you get thirsty, stop at a watering hole for a drink. While you are there, you can take a dip. And don't forget that elephants are fine swimmers. If you come to a house, knock on the door and politely say, "Has anyone seen an elephant?" And if no one has, then go deeper into the jungle. It may start to rain, but you can take shelter under a large leaf. While you wait out the storm, play a tune on your flute. You are bound to be hungry, so find a soft, shady spot and have your lunch. In case an elephant decides to join you, gather some bamboo shoots and tree bark for the elephant to eat. You will need plenty because elephants have big appetites. No pizza or chips, please. At some point, you will probably bump into a chimpanzee. If you're feeling brave, ask if you can swing on its vine. Be sure to jump off when you see an eagle's nest and ask the eagle to carry you over the trees to the edge of the jungle. When you get there, take a good look around. And if you happen to spot something big and gray, tiptoe closer. You'll want to see if it's an elephant or not. If it's not an elephant, then you'll just have to keep looking. And if you begin to feel tired, go to the top of a hill that has long, lush grass swaying in the breeze and some crickets to sing you to sleep. Spread out your blanket and lie down. Remind yourself to have sweet dreams of elephants. If you should be awakened by the ground shaking, and it shows him actually falling off the elephant's back because he thought that was just a mountain, and find yourself wrapped in a hug, now he's in the elephant's trunk, and lifted toward the sky, then you will know that an elephant has found you. And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now to close 5 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect, magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, when Darcy and Russell return to the mansion so Darcy could collect her stuff and leave, Russell's famous rock star dad, Wiley Sanders, answered the door. Keep in mind, Russell's dad played at the concert they both went to, but Russell did not return with his dad. While Darcy is waiting for Russell to return with her stuff, she starts walking around the enormous mansion. And that's where I left off last week. I could see Russell standing off to the side of the room, talking to a dark-haired woman in her 20s who was holding an iPad. In addition to them, there were a lot of people in this house. There was a big group sitting around a massive dining table, which was right in front of floor-to-ceiling glass windows. And through the sliding glass doors, I could see the backyard and a huge pool glowing with soft, subtle lights. There were at least 8 people sitting around the table, including Wiley Sanders. And most everyone seemed to be talking at once, laughing and yelling, their voices overlapping. It had to be getting close to 11 at night. Why were all these people here? And who were they? What was going on? The woman with the iPad walked across the room toward me, and I stepped quickly into her path. Hi, do you know where my stuff is? She raised an eyebrow at me, and I realized a second later I'd asked this in the stupidest way possible. I'm Darcy, I said, and her eyes widened in recognition. Kendrick and Belle brought my things somewhere. She nodded. Russell just asked me the same thing. I looked over and saw that he'd now joined the group at the table. The woman gave me a nod and started to walk again. I'll track it down. Are you staying for dinner? No, I began, but she was walking past me and into the kitchen. I started to follow when a pony stepped into my path. A second later, I processed that it wasn't a pony, but I wasn't that far off. It was a Harlequin Great Dane with ears that stood straight up. It was light gray and dappled with black spots all over. This dog was huge. Its head was higher than my waist, and as it plodded over to me, head cocked to the side, I just blinked at it, trying to make sense of this massive creature that had suddenly appeared. "Oh, right," the woman with the iPad called, looking over at me from the kitchen. "That's Tidbit."
"Tidbit?"
"Darcy." I looked over and saw Wiley Sanders walking from the table to the kitchen. He was motioning me over with a smile. "Come meet everyone." "Oh," I called to him, still trying to get my head around the fact that Wiley Sanders knew my name. "I just need my stuff."
"Hmm,"
he asked, cupping a hand around his left ear. "Come on." Maybe thinking he was being called. Tidbit padded gravely over to him. Wiley scratched his neck without even having to lean down to it. Clearly getting jealous, Andy stood up from under the table, shook himself, and ran over to Wiley, walking under Tidbit to accomplish this. Feeling like I really didn't have a choice, I walked over to the kitchen, where I could see that in addition to the woman with the iPad, there was a South Asian woman in her 30s who was stirring something on the stove. "Give us your opinion on this pasta sauce," Wiley Sanders said to me with a kind smile. "Yes," the girl at the stove said as she turned around looking irritated. "Everyone keeps adding stuff to it, and they're messing with its integrity." "We just want to eat, Priya," the woman with the iPad said, a faint southern accent lurking in her words. "We're trying to move the process along." "And we will," Priya said, "when the sauce is right." She looked at me expectantly. "Oh," I said, shaking my head, even though my stomach growled in spite of myself, "I'm actually not staying." "Hey," Wiley Sanders yelled to the room at large. When nobody at the table paid him any attention, he put two fingers in his mouth and let out an ear-piercing whistle. Every human in the room stopped talking, even as the dogs started barking frantically. "Hush," he said in the dog's direction. "Everyone," he continued, raising his voice. He pointed at me. "This is Darcy. She's Russell's friend." 11 people and two dogs turned to stare at me, and I felt my face get hot. Russell, I noticed, was deliberately not looking in my direction. Wiley smiled at me and took a comically large breath. "Ready?" I said, not exactly sure what he was talking about. "That's my daughter Montana," he said, starting at one end of the table. I tried not to do a double take when I realized I recognized her from her yacht escapades. She looked like she was in her late 30s with long, dark hair, and she waved at me cheerfully. "My son Connor, her brother," Wiley continued. Connor looked it like he was older than Montana, in his 40s maybe, with a sandy beard, but I could see the resemblance between them. "His wife Sydney," Wiley continued, pointing to an Asian woman next to Connor. She gave me a friendly, if slightly confused, wave. She was wearing a very cool jumpsuit and had perfect, straight-across, blunt bangs. "My son Wallace," he continued, nodding at a guy in his late 20s who, bewilderingly, had a pile of small, folded pieces of paper in front of him. He was black with trendy, oversized glasses. "Russell, you've met," he continued, and we made eye contact for half a second before looking away again. "I'm Wiley," he said, and then chuckled, like it was the best joke he'd heard in a while. "Dad!" Wallace, Montana, and Connor groaned in unison. "Now," he said, gesturing to the other side of the table, where three women were sitting. They all looked back at me, and I felt my eyes widen, because I recognized all of them. I was looking at three of Wiley Sanders' ex-wives. But what were they doing here? And sitting next to one another? "This is Kenya," he said, nodding toward a regal-looking black woman wearing a flowering caftan. I gave her a smile, hoping it wasn't clear that I recognized her from paparazzi photos and red carpet pictures. "Wallace's mother and my ex-partner." "Nice to meet you," Kenya said, sounding polite but confused. "Connor and Montana's mother, Paula," he said, gesturing to the white woman sitting next to Kaya. She gave me a nod and a smile, the smile I recognized from when she had been featured on the cover of the Nighthawk's second album, wearing a statement necklace and not much else. Now, though, she was wearing a buttoned-up shirt over a bathing suit, her silver-streaked hair damp. "And this is Chloe, my wife." I nodded, still trying to get my head around all of this. Chloe was probably the ex of Wiley's I was most familiar with, just because she was the most recent. She was as stunning in person as she had been on the cover of People, after she and Wiley had gotten married despite only knowing each other for a weekend. "Fifth Time's the Charm," the headline had touted. She had long blonde, wavy hair and dark blue eyes. She had a dusting of freckles, and I could see a constellation of tiny earrings in her ear, multiple piercings. She was wearing slouchy sweatpants that said Free City on one leg and a white t-shirt, but somehow these didn't look like the sweats and tees I normally wore. You could somehow just tell they were expensive. And while I knew she was Wiley's ex-wife, I'd read all about their contentious divorce, the fight over their twins. Sitting here with no makeup that I could see, she looked incredibly young. Younger than most of the people at the table, and that included Wiley's kids. A second later, I also realized that she was the girl in the sci-fi oil painting in the foyer, the one who'd commissioned it. "Hi, Chloe," said, drawing one leg up. "Darcy," she raised her eyebrows at my name. "Pull up a chair. Allegedly, we're eating dinner." "I'm working on it," Priya called, sounding stressed. I lifted my hand in a wave that I immediately regretted. Hi. I tried not to sound as baffled as I currently felt. But I was truly stunned by what was in front of me, the web of exes and kids and partners that had just been laid out. What was going on? Why were all Wiley's kids from different relationships hanging out together? Why were three of his ex-wives all sitting next to each other, none of them in a screaming match? Weren't Wiley and Chloe going rounds with lawyers over the custody of their twins? That was what I had heard was going on. At any rate, what was happening here? I glanced over at Russell, and he met my eye for just a second before looking away. I felt my anger rise again as I thought about what he had told me, that he was an only child, how he'd pretended to agree with me to know what it was like. And here he was, surrounded by a family that was living proof of the lies he'd told me. "This is Priya, Montana's partner," Wiley said, and the woman at the stove gave me a nod. Brunnen, who keeps the wolves at bay, he said, indicating the dark-haired woman in the kitchen who was still bent over an iPad. Astrid and Artie and Dashiell are here too. But they're sleeping, he said, checking these off on his beringed fingers, then turned to me. So, any questions? I actually had a lot, including, but not limited to, where my possessions were. But before I could answer, Wiley was continuing. Everyone, please give Darcy a nice Sanders family welcome, okay? So she doesn't think we're complete savages and reprobates. She's going to be disappointed when she finds out then, Montana said with a grin. She shot Russell a significant look, like she was indicating she thought I was a lot more than a friend. Russell, however, just stared pointedly out the window. Name a celebrity, Wallace said to me, adjusting his glasses, pen poised over a scrap of paper. Wallace, Kenya chided, taking a sip of her wine. Is that how we welcome guests? He rolled his eyes. Hi, welcome. Name a celebrity. What? I looked around, but everyone was just looking at me unexpectedly, nobody explaining what was happening. Was this some sort of weird Sanders hazing ritual? Was I supposed to say Wiley Sanders? Or was I not supposed to say him? Just anyone, Connor said. We need it for Fishbowl. First person that comes into your head, Sydney added, giving me a smile. Wallace pointed at me. Go. Steve Gutenberg? The second I'd said it, I regretted it and felt heat flood my face. Steve Gutenberg? Deafening silence greeted this answer, and I saw Wallace widen his eyes at Connor before looking back at me. Sure, he said, nodding. Thanks. Good pick, Wiley Sanders said, cheerfully to me, which somehow made everything worse. I was getting pitted by a multiple Grammy winner because the only celebrity I could think of was Steve Gutenberg. It was like a nightmare, but one I hadn't had before because I hadn't been creative enough to think up these specifics. Wiley steered me away from the table and toward the kitchen. Now, sauce help? I was actually here. Priya was suddenly shoving a spoon at me. Opinion, please. I took the spoon from her, figuring it was the path of least resistance. It was a vodka sauce and good until the end when it suddenly got very spicy. Ah, I said, trying not to look like my mouth was on fire. Good. A little spicy? She whirled around to face the dark-haired woman who was still bent over her tablet. I told you, Bronwyn, we didn't need that extra pinch of chili flakes. She glanced up from her iPad. I'm from Texas, she said. Don't ask me about spice level if you don't want a real answer. I noticed she was dressed a little more professionally than everyone else, who were mostly in sweatpants or bathing suits with cover-ups. She set down her iPad with a relieved sigh. Okay, there's no chatter about the hotel. We're monitoring the social media accounts of the Silver Standard employees and front desk workers, but nothing so far. And CJ's going to be getting NDAs to them first thing tomorrow. Wait, what's happening? Priya asked, frowning. Nothing, Bronwyn said cheerfully, because I'm very good at my job. She turned to me, Bronwyn Taylor. I handed Mr. Sanders PR. I just wanted you to know it looks like everything is locked down in Jesse. Where? Priya asked, turning around from the stove. Stop distracting me if you want to eat. Are we eating? a man in his 50s wandered in. He was black and wearing a sweatshirt that read Sedona. "It's getting late," he stopped when he saw Russell. "Russ is back," he said, smiling at him. "Where did you come from?" "Oh, that's Darcy," Kenya said, indicating me. "Darcy, this is my husband, Doug." "Hi, Doug." Hi, Doug said, nodding at me. "Nice to meet you. Are you staying for dinner? Is dinner happening anytime soon?" "I'm working on it," Priya cried from the stove. "I have to cook for all these people, you know, and then two more show up." "It's really okay," I took a breath, about to explain that I wouldn't be staying or eating any more of her very spicy vodka sauce, so she didn't have to include me in her count. "Don't pressure my girlfriend," Montana called from the table. "I'm just hungry," Doug grumbled as he walked over to Kenya and kissed the top of her head. "I don't think it's unreasonable to expect dinner before 11 at night." "Pretend we're in Spain," Chloe said with a smile. "So we'll continue to monitor this," Bronwyn said to Wiley, her voice a little softer now. "But I don't think you need to be concerned. We've got the situation well in hand." I suddenly realized that I had just been guilty of an egregious lapse in manners. But in my defense, nobody had ever used their celebrity status to get me out of a jam before. I knew I needed to thank Wiley Sanders. It should have been the first thing I'd done. But should I also offer to reimburse him for the helicopter ride? For the legal counsel? Mr. Sanders, I said, I just wanted to thank you for helping out. Russell glanced over at me and his mouth twisted in a frown. I'm so sorry that we put you in that position. I didn't know why it was important to me that this rock star I'd never see again knew that I wasn't the kind of person who went around breaking into hotel pools. But for whatever reason, it seemed to be. I'm really sorry and really grateful. He gave me a smile. You're welcome, Darcy. I was happy to help. Chloe snorted, got up from the table, and walked into the kitchen with her wine glass. Babes, she said to Wiley, rolling her eyes, you were livid. You were not happy to help. I wouldn't say livid, Chloe, Wiley Sanders demurred. She snorted again. Sure. Is there more of the suave blanc? Mama, I looked over to see a small blonde child in Spider-Man pajamas standing in the kitchen. Artie, she said with a smile, what are you doing out of bed? Russell had mentioned an Artie, but he'd told me that was his cool older cousin, not a 3-year-old, which meant this was one more lie. Russell had told me. I glanced over at him, but he was laughing with Wallace about something, probably about me picking Steve Gutenberg. Chloe scooped Artie up and rested him on her hip, and I was jarred by it all over again. How young she looked, too young to have been married, divorced, and the mother of a kid old enough to have superhero preferences. Artie, help us out, Wallace called across the room to him. Name a celebrity. The Rock, Artie said immediately. Thanks, bud, Wallace said. He shot me a brief look, one that clearly said, was that so hard? Did you wake your sister up? Chloe asked him. I didn't, he protested, trying to wiggle down. I'm just hungry. Oh, try my sauce, Priya said. She turned around with an apron, just as Artie spotted Russell across the room. Russell, he yelled, and launched himself in his direction. Russell grinned when he saw him coming, a real smile, one that opened up his whole face. He got out of his chair, picked up his little brother and swung him around.
"Where were you?" Artie asked. Even as he laughed, clearly delighted to be flying around in circles.
"You didn't come back on the plane with everyone, and you promised me that you were going to play Brontosaurus."
"Sorry, bud," Russell said. He stopped spinning him and set him down.
Artie took a few wobbly steps. "We can play tomorrow, okay? Or now?"
"No," Wiley and Chloe said in unison.
Artie grabbed Russell's hand and started pulling him toward the kitchen. Russell met my eyes, and I could tell that this was the last place he wanted to be, anywhere in proximity to me.
"Can we go swimming?" he practically yelled.
"Take it down a notch, bud," Wiley said.
"Yeah," Chloe agreed, glancing upstairs. "Your nephew is sleeping."
I bumped on nephew before I remembered how this worked. Presumably, one of Wiley's older children, like Connor, most have kids of their own, which would mean that this three-year-old was someone's uncle.
"Want some pasta, kid?" Priya asked, taking her pot off the stove.
Artie's eyes lit up.
"Yes, please," he said.
"I like the bow kind, with a little butter and the cheese from the green can."
"I have this green sauce."
"No, thank you. At least try it."
"Hey, buddy," Montana said, walking over to the kitchen. She tickle lunged at Artie, who shrieked in delight and ran a few feet away.
"Dinner almost ready, P."
"Fishbowl is ready," Wallace called, sounding irritated. "Are we not playing?"
"After dinner," Sydney said, clapping her hands together. "I need to eat something or I'll get grumpy."
"Get grumpy."
"Get grumpy?" Connor asked. She whacked him on the arm.
"Before we eat," Wiley Sanders said. He clapped his hand on Russell's shoulders. "We need to have a chat."
And unfortunately, this is where I'm going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.